This week on Life and Faith.
There's something that we're doing that's creating this pressure cooker environment and this performance environment for young people where they do believe their identity comes down to a number. And if they don't reach that number at the end of the HSC, then they're not worth something. And then it's not just after that, it's the whole anxiety building up to the HSC or to NAPLAN when you're even in year three, for that matter. So there's a lot of performance anxiety for our young people.
We're scoring about 5% in our test of what's the universe made of.
The Bible describes the real world as we know it. It has the ring of truth.
What kind of country is it that we live in when you can't tell a child why his father was killed because you didn't want him to grow up hating white people?
Does the human race deserve to continue?
Welcome to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Justine Toe.
Now, this week marks the release of the annual Mission Australia National Youth Survey. Each year, this youth survey takes a snapshot of how young people see life and how they're feeling. And it surveys about 25,000 young people from the ages of 15 to 19. For the last several years, there's been a couple of usual suspects in terms of the stresses on young people. And they've singled out coping with stress, school and study issues, body image issues as the big things that they're struggling with.
But today we're not going to be talking about that report. We're actually going to be focusing on an earlier report that Mission Australia and the Black Dog Institute released in October. That one's called Can We Talk? 7-Year Youth Mental Health Report. And it puts together in the one study all the findings around youth mental health of the past 7 years. And the results aren't great.
And just a caution, we do talk about suicide in this episode. So perhaps listen to it when you're out of earshot of small children particularly. But let's hear more about the report, Justine. What are some of the findings?
Well, I guess its biggest finding is that almost a quarter of young Australians are experiencing mental distress of one kind or another. And this represents an increase of about 5.5% over the last 7 years. The report also finds that Aboriginal young people have higher rates of psychological distress than non-Indigenous people, and that twice as many young women as young men struggle with mental health. So I guess the biggest question is why? Why the increase? And why young women double that of young men?
Yeah, I have to admit, that surprises me. I wasn't expecting that. Not minimising, of course, what young women are struggling with. But you hear a lot about men and boys and their struggles in this area. So I wonder, are they under-reporting how bad they're feeling?
I think there's definitely an aspect of that. There are a couple of things to consider here. I spoke to Dr. Jo Fildes, who's the head of research and evaluation at Mission Australia, and her team runs the Mission Australia National Youth Survey, as well as Dr. Colette Smart, a child psychologist. And I got from them this sense that young women are probably more likely to report their struggles in this area than men. We're going to be also hearing from the interview that you did, Simon, with Nick Newling a little bit later on. He runs that organisation, The Champions, that encourages people to open up about their mental health struggles. Yep. And he founded it after a terrible struggle with his own mental health as well. But in terms of that worsening picture of mental health among young people generally, I spoke to Dr. Fildes and she had something really interesting to say. She said she wondered whether young people have more stresses around them as well as less support mechanisms than they did previously.
So we've seen that a lot of young people, you know, are really struggling with, you know, knowing what they're going to achieve when they've left school. Sort of the complicatedness of trying to juggle everything that's happening to them, whether it be sports, music, school. A lot of young people are also working. You know, the work environment, you know, so paid employment is very unsure for young people. So we hear a lot of that sort of like that, you know, they have so many commitments on that they find it very hard to cope with their schooling as well. And knowing what's going to happen to them in the future, I think is very insecure. And that's what young people know to us.
That's quite fascinating because hearing you talk about how they're trying to juggle school and various other commitments, including perhaps work, it sounds as though that they are adulting before their time, really.
I think some young people are. Some young people who we hear from certainly are, you know, working to help their family out, to pay, you know, to pay the bills and to, you know, to do those things which, you know, we weren't, you know, a few years ago they weren't expected to do. You know, that is a economic crisis, you know, wage rises are very high. So young people are certainly contributing. Some young people are certainly contributing to their family. Other young people are working because they want to gain those skills so they can get a job when they leave school, yeah. And they're struggling with that as well. So yes, it is adulting before their time.
Well, the picture she paints is worrying, isn't it? All these findings have implications for government policy as well. The Productivity Commission has recommended that schools put a well-being counsellor in place for their students because, and this is what Productivity Commissions do, they say it's costing the economy billions of dollars a year to cope with mental illness. So it's trying to address those things before teens are hitting adulthood.
I think that makes a lot of sense, but ironically, I think the naming of the Productivity Commission actually puts its finger on the issue, this idea of productivity. And feeling that pressure to perform across a number of domains also cropped up in the experience of others that we spoke to, like Michelle Besson, who's this 20-year-old university student who opens up about her struggles with achievement. But first, we also spoke to psychologist Colette Smart, and I asked her about the pressure young people feel to perform in school.
We certainly know that young people are facing immense pressure. We've seen a lot of stuff in the media and call at the moment to kind of scrap NAPLAN and scrap the ATAR for the HSC and so on.
Do you mean because young people are feeling as though their existence boils down to the number that they get?
Yeah, pretty much. So, and the idea that you are not defined by a number, there's something that we're doing that's creating this pressure cooker environment and this performance environment for young people where they do believe their identity comes down to a number. And if they don't reach that number at the end of the HSC, then they're not worth something. And then it's not just after that, it's the whole anxiety building up to the HSC or to NAPLAN when you're even in year three, for that matter. So there's a lot of performance anxiety for our young people.
Michelle, we have a real-life young person in the room. Michelle, I saw you nodding when Colette was talking about that incredible pressure leading up to the HSC. You clearly identify with that.
Yeah, I think I was just thinking on a micro level, even just standing outside the hall before going into our HSC, there's comparisons happening between the notes that we're taking in and what we're writing, what we're not writing. And then if you're not writing the same thing as someone, you're like, oh, I'm not going to do as well as them because I don't have the same notes. And then, the HSC finishes and everyone's comparing how their exams went and so forth and sharing it on social media. And then, the numbers come out and everyone's almost too scared to ask what they got, which I find funny because we ask all throughout high school and then all of a sudden the HSC, like the ATAR's taboo and we can't go there. Mm.
Michelle went on to say that social media and all that anxiety over achievement fed into and reinforced each other, and it created a culture of comparison that just enhanced people's mental health struggles.
Yes, well, that's for sure. It's also the case that Colette Smart wanted to clarify that, yes, social media could often make people feel worse about themselves, but she wanted to say internet's not all terrible. There are a lot of great apps that are online and available and helpful for people struggling in this area. Now, we'll make sure we put a list of those on our website.
But Simon, at this point, let's bring in your interview with Nick Newling, because Nick also experienced that pressure to achieve that Michelle talked about. But I think as will become quite clear, Michelle is somewhere on that spectrum of anxiety, and Nick found himself at a very dark place, didn't he? Can you tell us who he is?
Yeah, Nick Newling's a young guy who advocates for initiatives in mental health. He gets out a lot and talks on this topic in schools and universities, at conferences, in the media too. He founded an organisation called The Champions, and the whole philosophy is this, is trying to get people to get out and talk to each other about their mental health struggles, which Nick reckons helps a lot. Now, he had his own very, very tough experience of this, and so he's drawing on that as he's trying to help people. When I first started talking to him, I asked him, when he was suffering, how bad did it get?
It got pretty bad. It started off as hard to define. It didn't really seem like mental illness to me. I didn't know what it was, actually. It just seemed like maybe it's what life becomes when you get into your teenage years. But what it really descended into pretty quickly was nonstop anxiety and depression and eventually even some features of psychosis, and I had to be medicated and hospitalized a couple times So it went from 0 to 100 pretty quickly in the beginning of high school.
Yeah, so you were early high school, right, when this happened?
Yeah, it was about halfway through year 7. So I had a really solid start to high school and had a really happy upbringing before that. I really enjoyed school, loved being there, had a view to go to uni and to be a vet and all that sort of stuff. And getting a scholarship to the school was a huge thing for me. And then, yeah, about halfway through year 7, I don't think it was the cause, but at least the catalyst was putting a lot of pressure on myself and just sort of believing that the only way to get any sort of happiness in life is just through achievement. And I think I really worked myself up into a bit of a frenzy and I just burnt myself out. And then launching off that, a whole lot of issues with mental illness.
Yeah, and I bet at the time you couldn't imagine much light at the end of that tunnel. It got pretty grim, right?
Absolutely, yeah. It's one of those things with mental illness, particularly depression, where it's not just feeling sad. I think a lot of people might misunderstand it to be, it's like the same sadness everyone else has, but a more intense version of it. And I don't want to speak for everyone. Obviously, it varies from person to person, but there's often a lot more to it than just that. It really can take away someone's feeling of self-esteem and their confidence, and might make people feel like people don't want to spend time with them. And a large feature of it is often that idea of hope for the future. And even if things are lined up perfectly that are conducive to having a great life and a great future, it's often near impossible to see that when someone's right in the thick of having a mental illness like depression.
Your mum and dad must have been excruciating for them watching you go through this difficulty. And had they had any experience of this sort of thing, so they knew what to do, or was this just an unfolding drama for them?
Yeah, I can't imagine what it's like for a parent to have to go through all of that, seeing all these different doctors, trying different therapies, and just none of them seeming to really work, in my case particularly. So, yeah, it's a huge challenge for parents. But, yeah, they did have, I suppose, a little bit of a heads up in that my two older brothers were also going through different issues with mental health at the same time. So there was at least somewhat of an understanding of seeing the early warning signs. But as far as then what, it's a pretty tricky thing to navigate.
Now, your older brother, Christopher, he suffered terribly and didn't make it, did he?
Yeah, that's right. Christopher ended up taking his own life when we were in high school. He was just shy of 18 and I just turned 16. And that really came as a huge shock. I was already in the thick of it myself. I was feeling very suicidal and I was quite open about that. And I'd talked to my family about it. And I guess we didn't really see how deep it ran for Christopher as well. I think he didn't really want to have people know too much about what he was really feeling. And I think he just sort of gave up on things despite actually being in the middle of getting help. He actually was seeking help and was getting treatment, but I think he was really holding back a lot in what he was really feeling.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity, and we're talking about youth mental health. And we've just heard that terrible story from Nick Newling about his own struggles with mental health and his personal tragic story of how his brother committed suicide because of his own somewhat hidden struggles, actually.
That was so devastating to hear. And I have to admit, I hear stories like this so differently now that I've got children.
Yes.
And especially I've got two boys as well. And hearing that all three boys in this family struggled so terribly and then Nick losing his brother to suicide, it was just devastating.
People would find, I'm sure, helpful Chris's mum's book on this called Missing Christopher. It's a really interesting book. It goes through the pain and the struggle of this, but also grief and trying to deal with that and the family's reckoning with mental health.
Now, Simon, when you mentioned that Christopher was holding a lot of those struggles to himself and not really sharing, I have to admit that doesn't sound unfamiliar to me.
I think we've made some good headway in this, but there is still, isn't there, this sort of idea of masculinity and what that looks like and being sort of stoic and you're not vulnerable. and not admitting to weaknesses. And it seems like that still contributes to a lot of this. But it's one of the reasons why, Justine, I was really surprised when we heard about the rates of mental illness among young women being double that of young men. Reported in this mental health survey. That's one of the reasons I was really surprised by that.
Well, you're not alone in that. This is what Dr. Smart had to say about that finding.
Look, that surprises me and doesn't surprise me. That sounds like a weird answer, but it surprises me in the sense that the report has found that with boys because of what we know about the statistics on suicide in boys and men. We know that 75% of all completed suicides are boys and men. We know that between the ages of 15 and 44 years old is when we are seeing suicides being completed in boys and men. More men die by suicide than car accidents. And there was a report out that where AMBOs and paramedics said that is actually the tip of the iceberg, because what they are seeing every day is that they get called out to homes where thousands of young men are either contemplating or just haven't succeeded in suicide. So to me, that's saying that our boys and men are in great grave trouble, but they're not reporting it. So even though statistics just say to me, let's just be careful we don't brush over boys because they are silently suffering and perhaps not reporting it.
Let me break in here. The report found that while most people felt like they had someone they could confide in if they needed to talk to someone, one in five people struggling with mental illness did not. And they were held back by stigma and embarrassment, fear and a lack of support. And you can imagine this stigma is worse for young men than young women. I asked Michelle, our 20-year-old uni student, if she experienced that stigma as well.
There's definitely a bit of shame that comes with not being okay. I think my generation, everyone wants to have it all together. Everyone, if you're at university, you need to be working a really busy job, you need to be doing really well, you need to have a social life. And so then when you're not okay, people are shocked and it's kind of, there's a bit of shame attached to not being okay. And so I think people internalize a lot of what goes on. And they don't tell anyone because there's so much pressure to be okay that they're not.
Did it get really difficult for you? Because, I mean, I guess if you're not able to tell other people, they don't know how you are, right? So you're dealing with this by yourself.
Yeah. I think reaching out is difficult because everyone around you is really busy, in quotation marks, and has it all together, again, in quotation marks.
Well, they look like they have it together.
Yeah. And so you start to make excuses for yourself and you say, well, that person can handle it. Why can't I handle it? And so then, you just start to feel more and more down on yourself when you can't live up to your own expectations.
Now, you're in university and in a second year of a psychology degree, is that right? Have you managed to kind of escape that loop of negative self-talk, or is it just amplified? Have you got a different set of worries to be concerned about now?
No, definitely haven't escaped it. It's ever present, I would say. But I think it's taken a different form now. So everyone now, for myself especially, everyone doing my degree wants to get into honours in the fourth year. And so you start to define how well you're doing by how well, like, you need to get a certain average to get into honours. And if you don't get into honours, you can't do psychology as a... you can't be registered and that kind of thing. So, the pressure just shifts into what you're doing, I guess.
So what was helpful for you then?
I think eventually I just reached out to my mum and I said to her, I need help. And then she's a psychologist herself and she sent me to a different psychologist and said, you just need to
talk
to someone.
I'm sure that was helpful. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was just opening up to one person, finding out what help is actually available and then taking it from there.
Can I ask you, so what's the difference between depression and like anxiety? Because what Michelle's describing sounds like anxiety to me, but it also seems like it's a generalized hum of anxiety that just pervades all of life.
Yeah, so we actually have something called generalized anxiety disorder.
Okay, great.
which does seem to pervade every area of people's lives when they're anxious. So you can almost just skip from one thing to be anxious about to the next when the last thing is solved or disappears. You do find many, many people, almost most people with depression will have anxiety as well. And depression is a different thing. You often have sleep issues. Either you are sleeping too much, or you can't sleep, have insomnia. Sometimes your weight will fluctuate depending on how you're eating. You're losing joy in things that you used to love doing, not doing those things anymore. Generally, the world seems to have a fog or a gray to it. It's a pervasive sadness that kind of seeps out of your pores, in a sense. And so it's really, once you've had that feeling for a period of time, it's really important to reach out for help, to go and see your GP as the first port of call, I'd say. Getting on top of anxiety and depression and mental health issues is so vital when you're young. We now know that if we can get young people help early, they're actually less likely to relapse as severely in adulthood. Young people can learn healthy habits early for dealing with anxiety and depression, and that's encouraging.
And so I totally see the value of having those healthy habits to sort of lift someone out of those issues, but are we missing a bigger picture here in terms of what are the good communities that we can be part of that can help us have a really firm sense of self? So it's not just about what number you get at the end of high school.
So I think healthy habits are not just things you do. For me, healthy habits include people and community, and I do actually agree with what you're saying in terms of, I think you're alluding to individualism versus collectivism, which is actually something I also talk about in my book. A lot of Western cultures really have bought into this whole individualistic idea. It's all about me, building me up, achieving my goals and my dreams. Now, that's not all wrong. It's not all bad. I do think we need to help young people know their worth, see their worth. They are created with worth. But in collectivistic cultures, now this is not to romanticize collectivistic cultures because I think there's strength in both, but collectivistic cultures look at the community. And I talk about this concept from Africa called Ubuntu. And Ubuntu is a Southern African concept, which really means you are you because of the other people around you. And what you do essentially ripples out and has an effect on everybody else. And so when you do well, your community does well. If you do badly, your community does badly. So sometimes in Asian or African cultures, that can cause issues where young people won't pursue dreams because they're afraid of bringing shame to their family, perhaps. So that's where it can fall down a little. But I do believe if we look at resilience, Emmy Werner's, she's late Emmy Werner, her stuff on resilience was fabulous. And she talks about four factors that lead to resilience in young people, and that is an enthusiastic adult. I like to call it an involved adult, because an enthusiastic adult can sometimes sound like you have to be an extrovert, and I'm actually so not. So really just an involved adult, having social emotional competence, and having values in your life, and then one of the interesting factors is having spirituality. Is a factor that we don't often hear about in the media, but spirituality is something that builds resilience. And that's an important factor that we forget to talk about with young people.
I might mention that the Oxford Handbook of Religion and Health found that 93% of studies into meaning and purpose found religion or spirituality associated with an increased sense of purpose and meaning. So there's obviously other benefits going on here as well when we talk about religion or spirituality.
Yes. So it's really, you know, sometimes when we talk about spirituality and we hear spirituality studied or see it studied. It's not always necessarily a Christian spirituality, but it's really looks at believing in something or someone bigger than yourself, outside of yourself. And very often in a lot of our spiritual or religious communities, well, I've just said the word, you're in community. You actually end up meeting with others, meeting with people you maybe naturally wouldn't meet with or choose to meet with as a friendship group. And that's a good thing. That's a healthy thing.
I want to appreciate that the studies say that religion has an actual effect. But are most of these effects that you're describing something that can just be boiled down to community life? Like what's the religious difference that might help embed that sense of security in someone's self?
In some of the resilience studies that I've already mentioned, it's not just being in the community, like being in a rugby team, for example. It's really about believing in something or someone bigger and outside of yourself. But we also just need to be careful that we don't assume because you're in a religious community that you won't have a mental health issue. You know, you join a religious community and then it's all poof, it's all gone.
You're still human, unfortunately.
You still bring you. But within that, you have perhaps a support system. You have something else to draw on. And it's also looking outside of yourself and seeing that your help can come from elsewhere. And so, yeah, there's a lot of facets to that.
Does that sound familiar to you, Michelle? You go to church, you run a youth group with young girls as well.
Yeah, definitely. I do agree, just because you're in a church or in a spiritual community doesn't mean that all the issues do go away. Still, week to week, I experience the pressure of performing, but it's coming together at the end of the week on a Friday night. And before we head out with the kids, the leaders come together and just we pray together, and we just know that we didn't do anything to get here. We didn't do anything good or perfect. We're not exactly worthy of being there, but God's already done those things for us. And because of that, we're accepted just the way we are. And we can take that acceptance into the community with the younger kids and sow that into their lives as well.
Well, that's an insight into the spiritual community Michelle is part of week to week, which supports her and offers her opportunities to give back to others as well. Now, you may not think that religion has the answers for you, but let's just finish on what Nick Newling, who's not a religious person, says about the role of meaning and purpose in his eventual recovery.
So alongside the medication and the talking therapy, I got a lot of support from family and friends, and that was absolutely invaluable to me. I really don't know where I'd be without all of them. So a lot of it was really having the ability to speak when I needed to and to be taken seriously and listened. And ultimately leading into after school and into my 20s, what I think one of the biggest factors in staying well and getting to an even greater level of happiness was really finding this sense of purpose and meaning. And I think that's often what the medical model can miss. We look at how do we get someone who's got a mental illness into feeling like their symptoms have subsided or, you know, better in some way. And then we often forget about, well, then what? Then what does a life look like of purpose and meaning? And that's often missed.
You've been listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity with me, Simon Smart, and Justine Toe.
And if anything in this episode has triggered something for you or someone that you know, please talk to someone. In Australia, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14 or chat to someone online at www.lifeline.org.au. And we'll also post links to those apps that Colette mentioned, as well as Nick Newling's website, and also a link to Jane Newling's book, Missing Christopher, A Mother's Story of Tragedy, Grief and Love. And you may also want to check out Colette Smart's book, They'll Be Okay, 15 Conversations to Help Your Child Through Troubled Times.
And thanks so much to Colette Smart, Michelle Basson, Nick Newling and Joe Fields for being part of this episode of Life and Faith. Next week...
Yeah, sometimes it comes down to just one lick, one riff, just that kind of opening, you know, that organ progression at the beginning of Where the Streets Have No Name, changes your life.
Yeah.
You're a lifelong fan after that moment. Mm-hmm.